Bhagavatam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anusansatami Bhagavad-gītē Bhavad-dvaiṣinī. It's going well. Purushaḥ prakṛtistho hi Purushaḥ prakṛtistho hi Bhunte prakṛtijāṅgunān Bhunte prakṛtijāṅgunān Kāraṇaṁ guṇasaṅgosya Karanam guna sangosya sarasadyoni janmasu sarasadyoni janmasu purushaha prakriti staha hi bhute prakriti prakriti jan gunan karanam guna sangaha asya sat asat yoni janmasu. Chapter 13 is the discussion between the kshetra and the kshetriya. And the kshetra is the field, the whole field of experience. And really, so interesting is Krishna. Or Krishna, when he's talking about the kshetra, when we say field, we mean the whole field of experience, but he only bothers with the field as the physical body and the mind, really. Because everybody takes this as the field of experience, but very few people take your own body as the field of experience. So the kshetra is the field of experience, which is really talking about the sharira, the deha, the physical body, and the sense organs, and the mind, you know. And the kshetrajna is the one who is the knower of the field. And so here, in this whole teaching tradition, there needs to be a viveka, a discrimination between who you actually are versus all of the things that you experience. The problem is that that discrimination hasn't gone far enough. The discrimination between me and the field is usually the body, mind, sense organs, this person, the jiva, this person here, becomes the kshetrajna, the knower of the field, and everything external to the body becomes the field. But as this unfoldment goes on with what Bhagavan is talking about here, the physical body we recognize is also the kshetra, because it's known by the same five sense organs that know the physical world. The sense organs are also the kshetra, the field, because they're known by the mind. You're very aware if you have sense organs or if they're working. They're also objectified. The mind also is the kshetra. It's also the field, because whatever thoughts you have, whatever emotions you have, whatever feelings, whatever memories, just the use of your mind in general, all of it is known. Even the I thought is the kshetra, because if you have an I thought, it is that. It's a thought. And so the viveka, the discrimination between the kshetrajna and the kshetra takes me right to what we call the purusha or the atma, the conscious being, which at the bottom line itself can't be objectified. In the end, who you are is not something that you can look at. Right? If you could look at it, then who's the one looking? So who are you? What is the bottom line of who you are? In reference to everything that can be objectified, you have to get to that conscious being who can no longer be objectified. If you can be objectified, then we have to go to the nature of the one who's doing the objectification. So the kshetrajna, the knower of the field, is that one. In fact, the knowership is also going to go away with the mind and the sense organs. But nevertheless, we do this viveka to take us to the conscious being that can no longer be objectified. So in terms of kshetra and kshetrajna, now in these last couple of verses, three verses actually, we've been using two, Krishna has introduced these two terms. It was actually introduced back in chapter 7. But we're reintroducing these two terms, Prakriti and Purusha. The Purusha and the Prakriti. Purusha is the conscious being, is the Pratyagatma, is Brahman. The Purusha is that one who's lying in the eight-gated city. The one who's lying there, the conscious being who's lying in the city of the Deha, the city of the body. So the Paramatma, really, is the Purusha. And the Prakriti is the field, whatever can be experienced, whatever exists within time and space, right? That is the Prakriti. The Prakriti is Maya. The whole Maya Upadhi is Prakriti. But here, because Krishna is focusing on the Prakriti, on the Deha, if you look in this verse, the Deha means the body, he says, the Purushaha Prakritistaha, who is abiding here in the Prakriti, in this body, mind, sense organs. So the Purusha, the conscious being, the Paramatma, the conscious being that you are, who is not subject to any type of objectification, who's abiding here in this Prakriti, in this body, mind, sense organs. Now, even when you say that, we have to look at the field of our experience here. There is me, the conscious being. I never take myself to be an unconscious being or inert. And so abiding here in this body, mind, sense organs, all of which are objectifiable, is me, a conscious being. This conscious being, from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, if I'm saying I abiding in this body, mind, sense organs. Okay. Now, if I say abiding in, when I say prakritistaha, that means I'm looking at myself from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs. Right? Because from my own standpoint, I'm not abiding in anything. Otherwise, I am this. If I'm really abiding in this, kind of like a little pea in a pod, you know, then I have a different type of relationship, that as though this, I belong to this. But actually, the conscious being that I am, the whole Vedas, the whole Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, the conscious being that I am is the one who is the conscious being in all beings. And so the Purusha, the one abiding as myself, is the one abiding as yourself, is the one abiding as yourself, is the one abiding as Ishwara. So the conscious being, so now why I'm saying this, if I say that the Purusha, the one who is abiding in this Prakriti, in this Deha, in the body, mind, sense organs, it is this one, Bhunkte, that enjoys. The Purusha, consciousness, the conscious being that I am, abiding in the Prakriti, enjoys all of the gunas born of the Prakriti. All of the gunas means all of the attributes that exist, all of the attributes that exist in duality. And also enjoys all of the emotions, the sukha, the dukkha, pleasure, pain, moha, delusion, also the one subject to avidya, ignorance. That Purusha, abiding in this Deha, enjoys all of that. From the standpoint of consciousness itself, it's not enjoyment of anything. Consciousness is just consciousness. This is such an important point. Your being is not doing anything. It's consciousness is not knowing something. It's not doing something. You simply are as a conscious being. In fact, as we do this, I didn't point this out in this meditation today, but we often do this. When you're just simply relaxing, so that there's really no nothing competing with your own presence. It's easy at that time, if you just notice yourself, one question to ask yourself is, am I doing anything? Is my being, the me, the self-evident conscious being that I am I doing anything? In fact, contemplation is so useful just to get to know yourself, even japa. You know, the repetition of a mantra is so useful because as you see the mantra, you know, rising and setting, you can ask yourself, every mantra, every time the mantra rises, it is known. mantra is known, mantra is known, mantra is known, mantra is known. Am I knowing it? Am I performing an act of knowing? Now this is it's a real viveka, because I start to understand or recognize myself, my being, as being the one who is just simply abiding. But everything that comes into my light, into consciousness, everything that comes into my experience is known. It's not that I'm doing anything. The thought comes into my being and it is known. It's kind of like the sun. Anything that comes into the sunlight is illumined. It's not that the sun is going out of its way to illumine the object. The object simply is illumined. And like that, every experience that I have is known, is illumined. Okay? But the fact that there are experiences to be had, that there is a mind there, that there are sense organs there, that there's a body there, right, means that the luminary, the conscious being, is abiding here in this body, mind, sense organs. From the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, right? So say if I look at, let me just do this just a little bit, because I really want you to understand this. If I look at my own being, just the conscious being that I am, and I recognize, and each one of us recognize, well, this body, first of all, this room is known. I need not do anything. My sense organs are open. My mind is there. The room is known. Then I can notice, and all of us are noticing that. Okay, so this is objectified. This is the kshetra. Then I can notice, you know, through my sense organs, this physical body is also known. Again, I'm not doing anything at all. It's just that my sense organs are open, my mind is there. And so the mind, if my sense organs are focused on this physical body, and my mind is using my sense organs, then naturally this body is known. That's true for all of us. So the body also becomes a kshetra, field of experience. I can notice also that I can say, well, you know, my sense organs also, I can with my mind, if I focus on my sense organs, then how well they're functioning, everything about them, that also is known. Again, I'm not doing anything. My mind is doing something. It is directing, as an instrument, it's directing its attention toward the sense organs. And so therefore, whatever vritti or thought modification is taking place in the mind, that is known. Again, I'm not doing anything. Consciousness is not doing anything. But as the vritti, as the thought modification takes place, it is known. Now, say I look at the mind itself. Again, every thought, every emotion, even the I thought, every memory, every experience that takes place in the mind, just by the fact of the experience taking place, it is known. I'm not doing anything. As long as the thought modification is there, that thought modification is known. And it's true for all of us. None of us, from the standpoint of the Atma, the self, nothing is being done. It's just that your being is consciousness. And so all experiences rise up into consciousness. And because they rise up in consciousness, they are known. It's not that consciousness is knowing them. See the difference? It's a huge difference, because otherwise the purusha that's abiding in this body, you know, from the standpoint of this body, if I give knowership to the purusha, to the conscious being, to you, then the self that you are is not the self that I am. It's not the self that you are. It's certainly not the self that Ishwara is. Because I don't know what you know. I'm not having the experience, the mental experiences that you're having are not the mental experiences that I'm having. The perceptions that you're having are not the perceptions that I'm having. And so, if the reason I'm having the experiences that I'm having is because consciousness is a knower, you know, then you and I are all different. Everyone is different. But if consciousness is just consciousness, conscious being, then that conscious being illumines whatever is in front of it. And so that conscious being which I am illumines whatever minds are in front of it. Whatever is, and in fact, to get just a little bit technical, if we look at the Maya as those three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, everybody's mind is made of sattva as a material. Sattva is that which reflects or enjoys or allows for the manifestation of consciousness. The Vedas, the Upanishads, say that the whole Ishvara Upadhi, the whole Maya Upadhi, the infinite expression of this creation that we call Ishvara, the Lord, that sattva runs through the entire creation. So does rajas, the principle of activity that allows for motion. So does tamas, which allows for all the manifestation of nama rupa, of name and form. This runs through, pervades the entire creation. It's not like there's a little sattva over here, a little rajas over here, a little tamas over here. It's pervasive to the entire creation. But from the standpoint of anyone in the creation, this physical body, right, this form, this physical body, is different than your physical body. If we take the five elements, space, air, fire, water, earth, and look at them in terms of this universe, all of the elementals, all of these bodies and the rug and the chair and the plants, there's all, everything is so different. And all of these bodies, tamas, you know, all of the human bodies, plants, animals, all of them have a different quality than, say, the table or the rug, you know, or the chair. These things we call inert because from their own standpoint they don't reflect consciousness. But you and you and you and the plants to a lesser degree and the animals, they have what we call, they have minds and sense organs which are sattva, subtle bodies which are sattva, which reflect consciousness. And so whenever there is sattva, the sattva that pervades the whole creation, there's the reflection of consciousness. The sattva that is limited by the physical body, there's the reflection of consciousness. Right? And so because there's a reflection of consciousness here for me, and not here for the table, I will say, I am a conscious being in an inert world. Because the table's inert, and this is inert. You know? And so, in fact, you're a conscious being, and here, what are there, like 10 or 12 of us in here? There's 12 conscious beings in this room that is basically inert. So we all become pockets of consciousness. That's because knowership is given to consciousness, really. We should just give the knowership, the illusion of knowership, to the mind and the sense organs. I say it's an illusion of knowership. Absolute illusion of knowership, because you never experience knowership. You only experience known. Whatever you experience, that experience is known. But we give that knowership to the sense organs in the mind. Because without the sense organs or the mind, these things wouldn't be known. And so they become the knower. See what I mean? But really, in terms of your experience, there is only known. The word known is really just a synonym for consciousness. If you look at it, this world is known, my body is known, the sense organs are known, the thoughts are known, the emotions are known, the I thought is known, I am known. So when you sit, and with one wonderful thing about meditation, when you're sitting so relaxed, just being with yourself isn't doing anything at all. Your body isn't really, mind is not interfering because you're just letting them be. You've thinned out the tension. And then you just are. Just simply, you just are. And you are known. You are not known because somebody's knowing it. You're known because you are a conscious being, because that is your nature. That knownness is your nature, and everything in the entirety of your experience enjoys that very knownness. That's why for the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, the vision is really that all of this, the whole Ishvara Swarupa, the whole creation, is nothing but conscious being. one conscious being. We can look at the whole creation with the predominance of Sattva running through the whole creation, is what we call Ishvara. Ishvara isn't just the manifestation of creation. Ishvara is the conscious being, the me, you know, that reflects in the whole creation. So Ishvara plus Maya that produces the whole creation, the Prakriti, the Purusha plus the whole Prakriti, entire Prakriti, because of the Sattva, that whole Ishvara is known. So the creation, you have to look at the whole creation as a conscious being. And the self of that conscious being is me. The me that illumines this individual mind is the me that illumines your mind and the experience, the plant's experience and the animal's experience, the experience of all beings, all the devatas. That is the one same me, whether it be Ishvara, or if we look at Brahmaji, the creator, or Vishnu, the one who sustains, it's all Ishvara, you know, or Shiva, the one who resolves the creation. That's all just different aspects of Ishvara, all enjoying just the same one me. That me, that self, is what we call the Purusha. And here, we're looking at this me that is the self in all beings from the standpoint of the Prakriti, the body, mind, sense organs. And from that standpoint, I, the Purusha, becomes the enjoyer. Right? From my own standpoint, I just simply am. But from the standpoint of the mind and all of the qualities in the mind which are known, well, how are they known? They're only known because of me, the conscious being. And so in reference to the experiences that the mind is having, I am the enjoyer. If the mind is having sorrow, then the one who enjoys, I am the one who enjoys that sorrow. But not from my own standpoint, but from the standpoint of the mind, because the mind is known, the mind is experienced, who is the experiencer? Only a conscious being. But from its own standpoint, ever free. So this is the viveka. This is what I have to see, to feel free inside, to feel whole and complete inside. I have to be able to differentiate the wholeness of my being, just the simple me that I am, the Purusha, from the experiences that are being enjoyed in the mind. Those experiences couldn't be enjoyed without me because there would be no consciousness. So from the standpoint of the mind, I am the enjoyer, but because because of ajnanam, because of avidya, ignorance, the experiences that are presenting themselves to me, I take myself to be. And that's the problem, that's the samsara. The self, you're the Purusha, who you are, is not a samsari. There's no samsari for Atma. There's no samsari for your being, for who you are. The samsara, means the sukha, the dukkha, all of the calamities that happen in one's life, that when you say they're happening to me, that's because there's no viveka, there's no discrimination between my being, which is ever the same, and all of the experiences that are coming and going. And so there's a superimposition that because of ignorance that's taking place between me, myself, and the variety of experiences that are taking place through my mind and my sense organs, really through your mind. Your mind is using sense organs to give you experiences out here, and your mind from its own standpoint is capable of all kinds of emotions and reactions, and they're all brought about by avidya. And so that avidya, that ignorance, is what makes me take myself to be one with this body, mind, sense organs, rather than the satya-mitya relationship where I recognize the conscious being that this body enjoys. This body is a conscious being. I have to be able to say this, because it's true. This body is a conscious being. These sense organs enjoy consciousness. This body is me, the conscious being, true. These sense organs enjoy me, the conscious being. My mind is me. I am my mind. My mind is me, the conscious being. That's all fine. But I also have to recognize that this body, mind, sense organs are me, but I am free of it. That's the truth of it. They enjoy me fully, but I am free of it. That's this whole satyamitya. That relationship between Maya, the Prakriti, you know, and myself, is what creates is the difference between having knowledge and being ignorant. The one who has self-ignorance, the Prakriti is me, and I am the Prakriti. Right? The body is me, and I am the body. The mind is me, and I am the mind. That's the ajnanam. That's what we're all born into this. You know, it's not like somebody's born into this creation. We say that the jiva, the transmigration of the jiva, is beginningless. It's not like they had a prior condition where this viveka was there. Because how is the mind going to, the mind, whenever you're thinking, whenever the mind is up, it's conscious. Why shouldn't the mind say, I'm the conscious being? You need some viveka to be able to say that. It has to recognize, somebody has to hold up a mirror and say, you know, all of your thoughts, mind, in fact, in Upadesha Sahasri, Shankara writes one little chapter, and every verse is, oh mind, this is what is really going on here. You know? Oh mind, every thought you have, every emotion you have, every feeling that you have, all of those feelings, all of those thoughts are known. They all come into being, they go out of being. None of them are me. They're me when they're here, but when they're gone, I'm still here. What do you do? You know? When you're here, you enjoy me, and when you're gone, I still am. If I still am, when a thought comes and goes, and I'm still here, I'm not that thought. If I'm not that thought, I need to be able to differentiate. I need to ask myself that question. Who remains? Who remains? Who can't I get rid of? Every thought, every emotion, every experience, you can get rid of except for one. And that one is this me, the me that's non-objectifiable. That is the Purusha. That Purusha abiding in this Prakriti means from the standpoint of the Prakriti, that one is the one who becomes the enjoyer. And then he says, Kadanam Gunasangaha Asya. For that Purusha, the Jiva, subject to the ajnanam, the natural ignorance. Because of that Purusha's, the one who's the jiva that's suffering from the avidya, from the ignorance, because of their attachment to the gunas are all of the different experiences that come my way, because of the gunasanga, because of attachment to the gunas, that attachment to the gunas become the cause, the karana, for Sadasad Yoni Janmasu. Janmasu means it's the karana, the cause, in all of the births into different yonis. Yonis are different wombs. Good wombs and bad wombs. You know? Because of one's attachment, it's really born of avidya, born of ignorance, but because of the attachment to the different gunas, to the different qualities that are existing in the world, I want this and I don't want that. That becomes, that avidya-born, ignorance-born attachment really is the gasoline for taking births into good and bad wombs. So let me explain that a little bit. This is exactly what we call karma. Karma itself is born of ajnanam, ignorance, because your being is not performing in karma. Consciousness is not performing. If consciousness isn't a knower, is not an enjoyer, it's just pure being, you're the being that you are, which is whole and complete. And this is something I just want to keep pointing this out. When we use words like being and consciousness and pure consciousness, it's not really what it is. They're just words that are trying to point to you, the one who is always here. So we can say, what words should we use? We can't use the body. We can't say, you know, the one who is masculine or feminine, or the one who is tall or short, or the one who is of this or that age. Or we can't use qualities of the mind, you know, one who is smart or quick or talented. These are all qualities, you know, that belong to the mind or the sense organs or the body. They say nothing about you, you know. And so, well, what are we going to do? What words are we going to use? Well, we can say you, but if we say you, that word is ruined in a way because it's totally identified with the body, mind, sense organs. So if I say you, yeah, yes, me. So then we say something like, your being. Well, what does being mean? You know? Or if I say consciousness or conscious being, of course there's these teaching methodologies we use to keep pointing to what we mean. But in the end, those words like conscious being or just existence, they have to land on this sense of self, of me, that I can't get rid of. I can get rid of, let me just make this clear. I can think in my mind, well, I can't just get rid of this body. I won't get rid of this body until it dies. That's true. But you can get rid of the experience of the body as you do in dream or in deep sleep, or even if you're reading or lost in music or talking to somebody. It's not like you're always aware of your body. You can be without this experience. That's an amazing thing. You can't be without the experience of yourself, but you can be without the experience of anything that can be objectified. And so I can easily be, and many times during the day, moment to moment, I'm actually not having an experience of my body. I'm lost in my daydream, or I'm lost in my book, or I'm lost in my conversation, but then I'll always be checking back in. But say if I'm thinking about it in terms of thoughts, it becomes much more graphic because you can sit there and watch your thought flow. And if I say, you know, if a thought comes into being, you know it, and it goes out of being. It's one thought after another, after another, after another. You can't be those thoughts because they're gone. So who's there? Who doesn't go? What is the experience that doesn't go? I mean, mental experiences are coming and going all of the time, but the self that's present to those mental experiences doesn't go. When you go into contemplation and you're relaxing deeply, deeply, deeply relaxing, and then just turning toward your own presence, so many experiences go, right? Because you've turned away from those experiences. But there's one experience that doesn't go, and it's not an objectifiable experience. It is the experience of me. So, like, even if we can say so simply, you know, when you meditate, are you still there? And you would say, of course. In fact, I'm really the only one that is there, right? When I'm meditating and you're withdrawing all of your experiences, you're the one who is really still there. And very personally so. It's not somebody else who is there. Sometimes we have concepts of meditative flights into a self that is unknown, but actually that's false. The Brahman, the self that the whole, all of the Upanishads are revealing, is that you, the self that is always here, is the self that one needs to recognize. Now that self is Brahman. That self that I am is the one who is changeless, the one who is non-objectifiable, is the one who is the self in all beings. It is that one, that is me. And so in the end, all of these words like consciousness, wholeness, conscious being, existence, ananda, fullness, the words don't mean anything unless they land there. And then that one is the purusha, And that Purusha, that self, the one who's the self of, in all beings, is the one who is viewed as the enjoyer only from the standpoint of the experiences enjoyed. There's nobody enjoying them. That's not even true. They're being enjoyed as long as they're there. But if they're not there, then there's only me. And I'm not doing anything. I'm the very self of every experience. And so say there's a mental experience which is an experience of agitation. That's an emotion. That emotion is being experienced. We say it's bhunte, it's being enjoyed. Say there's a mind that has a shanta vritti, very peaceful vritti. That peace is being experienced, it's being enjoyed. Say there's a dark, angry thought. That dark, angry thought is being experienced, is being enjoyed. But what am I doing? What is consciousness doing? Does consciousness become the nature of the thought? I'd say absolutely not, because when the thought goes, you know, nothing has happened to consciousness. Nothing has happened to me. The experience is no longer there, that's all. When the experience is there, then that experience is, you know, they use the example of if I have a crystal, sputtika, if I have a clear crystal and I bring in like a red rose near the crystal, then that crystal becomes red. It appears to be red. But as I move the crystal away, then you realize, oh, it wasn't really red after all. Right? The rose was red, not the crystal. So like that, if I have a thought in my mind, or a mood in my mind, that mood belongs to the mind, not to me, not to the conscious being which illumines the mind. When that mood is gone, then the mood is gone. Conscious being, the me, is now, you know, illumining another thought, another emotion. So now what has to happen is I have to start recognizing, well, nothing's happening to me. These moods, some are pleasurable and some are not pleasurable. And that's true. You know, who wants to have an angry thought? I'd much rather have a fun, happy thought. But, you know, but from my own standpoint, I'm fine. I am the same me present to whatever thought is there. This is the viveka that has to take place. And there's so much freedom in that viveka, in that discrimination. Because then my mind has a self. You know? Otherwise my mind doesn't have the self. It is a self. It takes itself to be the self, and it's a very fickle self. So I'm feeling this way, I'm feeling that way, and doing this and doing that. I don't have any control over it. But yourself is always the same. So there's the stable, we call sometimes this very stable center that holds, but that center that holds, that is present to all experience, just it's always there, it just needs to be recognized. And so here, he says, that isn't recognized until it is. As long as the avidya is there, that's not recognized. And now what happens is, because of that, this jiva, the body-mind-sense-organs complex, this subtle body, gets trapped because of its attachment to experiences and the karma that is accrued because of that. This gets into the whole karma of, you know, punya and papa, you know, when I make choices, adharmic choices, so that I can fulfill my needs and fulfill my desires. Sometimes I go for adharma. Everybody tries their best, but, you know, we go through, we make wrong choices. You know? And so we accrue some adharma, we accrue dharma, accrue more adharma, some dharma, like that. And so they say, you know, in that accrual of that combination of dharma and adharma is what causes us to take better or worse births. You know, I'm not going to get into a whole unfoldment on this now, because we've done that before. But how it's viewed, though, just very briefly, is depending on the quality of your life, what has been important to you in your life, your value system, at the time of your death, You know, when there's really, at that time, there's really no free will, as you're kind of passing from this, leaving this body. You know, there's no real free will. There's just that sukshma sharira, that subtle body, at that moment of death, is who you are at that time, from the standpoint of experiences. You know, and so say if you've lived a basically a dharmic life, then at the time of death, that's the one that's going to be transmigrating. Kind of like a cause effect, cause effect, cause effect. You know, here's that last moment. And that last moment is just a culmination of your highest value. Of your highest values, what you're most attached to. You know, what really, what are you hanging on to at that time of death? And so if the life has been basically a dharmic and self-centered and selfish or whatever horrible things you want to say, you know, then that sets one type of trajectory. If the life has been, you know, had more subtle values, that will set a better type of, a nicer type of trajectory. Nicer means more punya, means a better birth, you know, a better birth where that jiva is drawn more into more of a dharmic situations, a dharmic household, because you yourself are dharmic. So what type of parents would you be born into? Mm. Parents who fit, you know? What type of conditioning would you be brought into? A conditioning that matches who you are, you know? Just like who now, and moment to moment to moment, who are we attracted to? What were attracted to those things that we're most attached to, that we have some simpatico with? That's where we go, you know? And so in your next life, where are you going to go? You're going to be drawn toward those things, those situations which match who you are. And so if the life has been had a lot of adharma in it, then that continues on its own way, you know, until you turn the corner. You know, and then the next life, maybe you've turned the corner and you've had a rough life, you know, but whoever, you don't know what kind of infinite number of karmas have conspired to bring you into the life you've had. A beautiful life, or a mediocre life, or a rough life, or one you think, oh my God, what I did, what did I do? The Indian will feel like that. You know, this is all my karma. You know, this is, and so let me do better this time. Let me do better this time. You know, it's a beautiful freedom actually to have that type of attitude. So here, you look at it, what Bhagavan is saying here, you know, it's really your attachment to all of the gunas. And what kind of attachment is it? Is your attachment to pleasure, you know, what we call prayas? Is it just attachment to your own pleasure, you know? Or are you actually, the more mature we become, your attachment is more to dharma than to pleasure. I would rather the kind of the formula becomes more like this. I would love to have that pleasure as long as it follows dharma. As long as it exists within dharma, I'm happy to enjoy that. But I won't enjoy that at the expense of dharma. And that's what we end up with. Because the enjoyment, you know, at the expense of dharma creates too many underlying stress and unhappiness. And so the pleasure becomes very hollow. I would rather forego the pleasure and enjoy the dharma. The dharma has much deeper and much more abiding happiness. And I feel much more at peace or in harmony with Bhagavan, with Ishwara. And so more and more, just as we assimilate experience over beginningless lifetimes, you know, as we assimilate our experience, we choose dharma over adharma, just because we've learned. And we learn and learn and learn. At some point, you know, how many times do you stick your hand in fire, you know, before you realize that's not a good thing to do? So how many adharmas do we do before we realize it's not worth it? You know, that there's no real happiness in it. Yeah. And so, you know, we learn and learn and learn. But as we learn also, you know, and your parents, that if you have a good birth, also your parents will help you with all of these things. Then we call them, you're more attracted to sadyonis. Sadyonis means into families of the good, people who have dharma. Or you're attracted into asadyonis, people who really, it's all it really means is people who don't have the dharma. They're not really committed to dharma. And then you have to grow up within that type of value system, and you have to get out of it. You have to work your way out of it. That's why they say, in this life of karma, birth after birth after birth, it's not just uphill. Like first you're a fish, then you became an amphibian. You know, and now finally all moving up. You know, now you're a human being, so you have nothing to worry about. You're just on the uphill. No. We say with evolution that's all fine, but the jiva, the transmigrating jiva, is going to take whatever form, whatever body is appropriate for really the karmas of your last life. Even though you have a countless infinite number of punya, which is called sanchitta karma, an infinite number of karmas in your sanchitta, in the whole unmanifest karmas, it's this birth, the trajectory of this birth that will decide which of those karmas will manifest into your next life. See what I mean? And so it can be up, beautiful birth, you could be a devata, and then you'd be reborn into a wonderful family, and then somehow you went astray, you know, and did all kinds of bad things, even though you had such a wonderful opportunity, something happened, you went off somehow, and then that sets you down, and maybe you'll be born as a monkey, you know, or a hyena or something, up and down and up and down and up and down. They do say, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna does say, Arjuna was so concerned about this, he knows about this, you know, up and down, up and down. He said, after Krishna had taught him almost the whole Bhagavad Gita, you know, he said, what will happen to me now that I have this knowledge? I have this knowledge, I feel clear, but I'm going to go back into the battlefield and I could be killed. And I don't think I've had enough time, you know, in those stressful situations to really own my knowledge, what you've taught me, what will happen to me. And Krishna said, you don't worry. You'll always pick up where you left off. Mm-hmm. You'll either be, he says, there's no ubhaya brashta, you know, where you're neither this nor that. You're just kind of left dangling there. No, that will never happen. You'll either be born into a house of yogis, here they mean yamis, people who have this knowledge. You know, just pick up from a young age and continue, you know, your process of maturation. Mm-hmm. Or you'll have some things to live out. You still have some things you need to get off your chest, whatever. And then, you know, after some years, you'll be united back with a teacher. Don't worry. You'll be fine. They say once you come, but I think it's true. It makes so much sense because until you recognize, become a mumukshu, somebody who really realizes that you can't really fulfill yourself on that deep level to be able to say all is well with me within samsara, because samsara is fragile. There's nothing constant here. And so once you really become somebody who's a mumukshu, who really desires liberation, that puts you, you're just in a different zone, so to speak. You're not no longer asking the world to do or expecting the world to do what you used to think it could do. Now you know it can't do that. And so your whole orientation is totally different. And so there's a kind of a line, you've kind of crossed over the line. And there's really no going back. Once you've crossed over that line, you can't go back because you can't become ignorant again. You know, and so you have to see it all the way through. Because once you see something, you can't not see it. You can't pretend like you don't know. You know, And so once a person becomes a mumukshu, that has to complete itself. And so if for some reason you don't get it in this life, that's what so many people, when they're old, they come to this teaching when they're really old, and they will all say, I wish I was like you. I come to this teaching when I was young. I'm so old. I'm not going to have time to really mature in this, because I came too old. but then that person, maybe they didn't get that opportunity to totally, you know, come into their knowledge. But when they die, they'll pick it up when they're young. According to the Shastra, they'll pick it up when they're a young child, or else when they're in their early 20s. And then some old person will come to them and say, I wish I would have gotten this. it all works itself out. So let's stop there. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om. These handouts are from Swami Dayananda's Gita Home Study. I'll give sections, you know, as we're going along. Mm-hmm. They're good to study.
I bought a Bhagavad Gita 10 years ago. Did I still haven't opened it.
This one's better.
I have it, you know. Yeah. Yeah. We have it. She's opened it.
The time has to be right.
Right.
Rather, if you're born into a family that's very non-dharmic, does that mean that the one that's born into that family has some bad stuff to work out? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. The problem with that
or
is that
it could be like, you know, the way the Buddhists say, you know, that's a gift because you get to burn up more karma or whatever.
It's all true, but the thing is, there's no way for us to know all of the laws that have gone into and all of the circumstances that have gone into the reasons why you have a particular birth. You know, we can say that we can't. It's infinite. You know, the laws, so we can make broad strokes, like we can say that, you know, the moment of your death, you know, just traditionally the moment of your death is important because that puts you on a trajectory for your next life. To the degree that a lot of times in Indian families, when one member is passing away, the family will sit around and chant, like Rama, 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 or just to bring into the person who's dying, into their mind, the name of the Lord, to try to help, you know, give some more punya to the direction of the jiva when leaving.
So they could come in with a very non-dharmic environment. But then the grace of Bhagavan can put them in the lap of the teacher and teachings, and then left that from last lifetime. It's just a question of timing.
That's right.
Yes.
All right. I'm okay then.
You're okay. Yeah. You know, but just think about it. For all of us, we have to be able to transgress through difficult situations and make right choices in order to get out of them. You know, if we have beginningless lifetimes, say that's what the Shastra says, there's beginning, not one or two, it's like a infinite cyclical creation, beginningless cyclical creation, and the jiva is considered to be beginningless, or beginningless lifetimes. You know, and so there's no question of us, you know, having not gone, getting lost here and there. But we have to get our way, we have to get out. We have to find our way out. And we find our way out really through assimilation of experience, our experiences, you know. Or the right person, or because of some punya. Remember, every life is considered kind of 50-50. 50% punya, 50% papa. I'm sure maybe it's not exactly like that, but something like that. People come along at the right time to give you a helping hand also. To help, to give you a choice. Sometimes we take the choice, the right choice, and leave behind the things that are not helping us. They even say, for a mumukshu, one who comes to say this teaching, you want to keep the company of the good. That's what satsang means, association with the good. That means with people who have a value system that you look up to, and you that actually people have the same value system as you do, or people that are helpful to you in terms of maturing. You respect them, you want to be like them. You don't want to be hanging out with, say if you smoke cigarettes, you don't want, and you want to quit, you certainly don't want to be, you know, hanging out with smokers. Or if you're drinking and you really don't want to drink, you have to, you know, pull yourself away, you know, from those type of people in order to give yourself the type of support that you need to get out of those type of habits. Once you're totally out of it, it doesn't make any difference. You can be with people who smoke, and you can be with people who drink. You can be with any people. It doesn't make any difference, but initially it does, you know, because you yourself get pulled into those things that you don't want to get pulled into. If that thread isn't there, then whoever it is, it's not a problem. But sometimes, you know, we want to go in a different direction than the group of people that we were total, that we were our community.
I think it's so helpful that Swamiji mentions about rather than, you know, we think, oh, we have to give this up, give that up, but he mentioned so well that no, it's really a question of outgrowing. You're going to outgrow certain things, you know, and that's huge. I think it's true.
You outgrow things and you let, and things drop off.
Yeah.
There's another thing too, is that when you, the more positive things you bring into your life, the less time you have for the other.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
The other thing I read this week that I don't know why, it just hit me this week, because we've been talking about it for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. But Swamiji just had one sentence in one of the commentaries on the verses, and it was something like, a vritti is simply a modification of inert prakriti. And it was like, oh my gosh!
You know, even that understanding, if you understand that there really any vritti or any experience, it's really just a thought modification, any experience that you have. Like say, for instance, you have a negative relationship with some coworker, and every time you think of that person, it gives you really bad feelings, makes you tense or angry or upset. All that's really happening is that particular image, because that person's not sitting there inside of you, right? That image or that thought creates constriction in your mind and body, which creates these emotions. The emotions are really nothing tangible. They're constriction in the mind. And so to break these type of associations, you can allow that image to come into your mind, you know, and then just allow your mind to relax in the presence of that image. And what you're doing, you're breaking an association. This image brings this feeling. But if you let the image be there and then just completely relax and relax and relax, don't push the image away or anything. This doesn't always work. It depends on how much stuff you've got going in around the image. But it can work. It can be very, very effective. You just relax. And that image stays there, but it loses the angst that it was carrying. It's amazing, really, because actually the person's not there, the situation's not there. There's just an association, that person that creates that tension in your mind. So I just say, let it be there and relax into it. And what happens is the negative stuff goes away, and then that person or that image just becomes like all other images. You've diffused it. It's a really interesting to play with that a little bit, because you realize that you're spending a lot of time hurt and upset when you absolutely don't need to. It's being mechanically triggered. These upsets are being mechanically triggered by associations with the image.
When that trigger goes off, it seems like you can still sense it. There's a constant. The me is constant, but it's submerged. Not submerged, but you're with the trigger rather.
It's overpowered. Emotions of the trigger overpower. Your presence is still nicely there if you're lucky enough to have noticed that you have a presence that's there, but the emotion becomes so much. But that's only because of constriction in the mind. So if you relax the mind, what you find, and just welcome that image, and then practice relaxing in the presence of that image, and the image is there, but there's nothing, it's meaningless. It's like any other image. So there's many, many different techniques with working with the mind that gets hurt and triggered. But this is one that is fun in a way.
So
easy.
So you're not relaxed if you keep saying to yourself, well, I want relief from this image or this.
Well, you do want relief from it, but that's why one way of seeing if this works for you is to just say, all right, well, let me just be with it for it. Just be with it. And let me relax in its presence. Yeah. And then what's happening is the image, which was carrying so much power, it's just neutralized. The thing is, the mind is funny because some of these images, we don't even want to think about them as images because we're just too mad, you know, about whatever situation that was happened, you know, or whatever the person did or something. We're just too angry at that person, so we don't want to let it go. But if you're ready. You know, at some point you realize, I don't want these kind of things in my mind. I'd rather just be relaxed, and I don't want these triggers. So once you become ready for that, then, you know, and for the areas that you are ready for, some you're not, you know, because you're too invested in the anger.
Well, it's like you say, you practice with small ones.
Yeah. But behind
you.
Yeah. But there's plenty of them, plenty that don't, you're not that invested in. And so you can practice, you know, on those. And it's just nice to realize that actually it's really I'm using the word illusory. I use that word very carefully. I never use that word illusory in terms of the whole Maya, but what's going on in your mind often is totally illusory. You know, we build up a lot of angst and things that need not be there. All you need to do is relax, and the same situation is there, and there's no problem. Means you're just objective, the people are there, the situation is there, but you're fine. You're just dealing with it and working with it without all of this angst going on inside. And so it's nice to know some of the ways to diffuse that. But there'll be areas where you may not be ready to diffuse it because you're so invested and seem so justified, feel so justified in having the anger, you know, that we're not really ready to work on it in that way. That requires just another little ways of dealing with.
So you shouldn't be angry when you don't have the sense that all is well with me in those kind of conditions. I mean, the presence of me is there, and the mind is constricted.
Yeah, you see, once you know your own being as really the source of any fullness that you ever have anyway, and what allows for the expression of that fullness, happiness, all the happy thoughts you have, what it really allows for it is relaxation of your mind. And like, if we use the example of if you have three water buckets, one is a clear water bucket, one's an agitated water bucket, and one's a muddy water bucket. And the sun is shining perfectly, beautifully in all three, illumining them. But in this one, this calm water bucket feels so fine. You know, the sun is vibrant and the sun is there in it is though. The agitated one, the sun is all like this. And in the muddy one, the sun's barely shining. This one's depressed. Mm-hmm. This one is really happy and peaceful, and this one's agitated. And the sun's fine. So all these water buckets have to do is settle down. And all, you know? So your mind, all that has to happen, because yourself is always there. It is not becoming better or worse. It's always the same. It's the very source of any wholeness or fullness that you've ever experienced in your life. It's because the mind is for that moment relaxed. Even you fulfill a desire, the mind for that moment is desireless. It's like the sun comes up because of the mind is relaxed. So once you know that dynamic, yourself is not going anywhere. All that has to happen is that your mind has to relax. And really, practicing relaxing the mind is not that hard. It's easy to do. We do have other things we have to know about. We have to know about how to be with the little ones inside and conscious processes and things like that. We have to know how to have like an inner friend, the way that you talk to yourself, the way that you talk to the mind. There's a lot of things we have to learn along the way. You know, you have to learn all of those things. Actually, these things should all be taught when you're in grammar school. But so we're not taught them, you know. So we have to learn them all now. But when you learn, you know, a handful of these ways of being with the mind, it's much easier for the mind to be relaxed and feel secure, especially once you know yourself. Yourself is the most secure, and you can't even hurt it. You can't do anything about it. Nobody else can either. Even Ishwar can't do anything. You know? Your being is so whole and free. So the problem is with the mind. So we have to, besides gaining this knowledge so that there's some real clarity there, we have to just learn some simple ways of handling our mind so we can stay relaxed. But I really like, you know, if your mind is worried or agitated, just invite it, you know, to just be there and just relax with it. And just watch the angst go away from the image. And then it's not that you don't have to deal with it anymore. You still have to deal with whatever the problem is. But not you don't have all of that negative affect for relief.
Sounds super easy.
Some things are very easy.
Kidding.
Some things are easy, though. They can be hard to make yourself try them. Mm-hmm. But once you try, they're actually very easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's not like learning Tamil or something.
It's definitely not like learning Tamil. If it was like learning Tamil, I'd just say, let's go home.
You turned the open side to closed.
So if the relaxation, I don't know if there's a name for this practice, but if it doesn't work to kind of unwind the conditioned reflex of the vritti of any particular one,
yeah.
I guess I'm thinking, you know, what are the other options? And one is maybe there's an inner child thing that needs to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's some kind of mentoring or
like the inner child is one where you're really learning how to talk to kind of the unconscious ones inside. If you come again, I'll do a guided meditation for you all, but something that we've done quite a bit, where you learn how to really ask the ones inside and the unconscious, does anybody inside have anything they want to tell me? A lot of times, a lot of them will raise their hands. But learning how to actually listen and be present to split off parts in the unconscious. That's very important, to learn how to do that. And the other is that how do you talk to yourself? Really listening to how do you talk to yourself. Are you a friend to yourself, or are you a critic? How did your parents talk to you? Because the way your parents talked to you when you were growing up may very well be the way you've just been talking to yourself all along since your childhood. Now, if they were supportive parents, you know, good friends, ones, good mentors, then you have a good voice inside, and you probably haven't even noticed it. But it's fine. But say your parents were angry, or had short-tempered, critical, or whatever, then you will most likely have that type of a voice inside. Like, if you're not doing something as well as you could, oh, for heaven's sake, you're so stupid, what an idiot. When are you going to learn? That's like a negative voice. And so most people aren't even aware that if they have a negative voice or a positive voice until you ask them to listen. Then if you listen, and then you have to ask, would I treat anyone that I know the way that I talk to myself? And if the answer is, yeah, I would, then you're fine. But it could be that, oh my gosh, I would never talk to anybody like I talk to myself. I'm so hard on myself. So many people say that, you know. I'm so hard on myself. I'm so critical of myself. But when that is the case, that's what you're living with. You know, say if you're living in a household with a couple of people like that, you don't want to be there. You want to go to your room or go away, because it's so painful to be in the presence of someone like that, who doesn't appreciate you, doesn't give you the benefit of the doubt, doesn't respect you, you know. It's painful. Doesn't even like you or doesn't love you, all of these things. You want to get away. But if you have that chatter going on inside, then, and there's nowhere to get away. So it's cruel in a way. It's almost like you're held captive by these negative, we call them introjects. But it's not that hard to change once you're aware, because you can say, I don't have to talk to myself like that. You know, I can be a friend. And if you say that to your mind, you don't have to talk, I don't have to talk like that. It can be a friend. And everybody inside, all the complexes inside, they'll go, what? Really? Everybody will get excited that somebody's going to be kind to me. Somebody's going to, you know, care. Really, the whole psyche perks up. Really, it's so amazing.
I've kind of noticed that. But are there others besides these three?
I think there's variations, like the way that that coming into relationship with your unconscious, the way you treat your conscious mind, you know, and then this relaxation in terms of the way you relate to the world. See, you can find yourself reacting harshly or negatively to the world where things are just, you know, bursting out. Behaviors that you don't want. You have to work on those kind of behaviors to change them. But sometimes if you first learn how to relax the mind when it gets tense, to just welcome in that tension and relax it, that really helps and mitigates, you know, the outbursts that we have. It's one of the ways that helps.
some people or situations can be particularly triggering.
Yeah.
And generate, for me at least, a kind of obsessive, like, thinking about them that's not serving.
Anyway. Not serving at all. That's what Boa knows. So
yeah, but just relaxing into it doesn't always seem to do the trick. Or maybe I just need more practice. I'm obviously relatively new to this. I'm just kind of thinking, you know, what to do when with particularly stubborn.
Well, there's a couple that say the relaxing doesn't. I think the relaxing does work, but you have to try it. But say another thing that is extremely, shockingly helpful and can be hard to do is what they call this pratipaksha bhavana.
Oh,
not that one.
No, we don't do that one.
I really didn't want to hear that.
That's where mentally you can say there's somebody that you really can't stand them. Or whatever. you imagine giving them a flower every day or doing some kind gesture to them just imaginally every single day or approaching them and saying something positive to them every day. Just imagine it. Okay, that can be hard to do, but what's really hard to do is to actually do something. But now it shouldn't be hard, but it is. Okay, it really can be hard. But say there's somebody that you really can't stand them for whatever. I mean, and there are reasons. So, what you do, what you have to do is you just walk by, go up to them, and you say something like, how are you? Just something nice, friendly. Just one sentence, and it will break the spell. The spell will come back, but it breaks the spell for that moment. And that's kind of shocking, you know, and you learn this, that by kind of a positive action toward the negative actually dispels it, because the spell is in your mind. It's not out here. It's actually in your mind, and your mind is very plastic, you know. You can change your mind on a dime, but you have to be willing to do it. And so by making a positive gesture, and you don't make it too hard on yourself. Like, you don't have to go up and have a big, long conversation. And you just have to go and say something nice. And you can always find something nice about somebody. They're not all black. Nobody's all black.
That's kind of like just being civil rather than cursing or something.
Well, civil, but you can be so cold. Hello. So you want a little bit more, you know, more of a gesture, you know. You have to practice it. You can't. These are just words we're talking. You have to actually practice it, and you see how powerful it is. The thing is, once you realize how powerful that is, it becomes easier for you to do it. Mm-hmm. Because you don't want to carry this hurt inside of you, or these bad feelings, because you can just carry them and carry them. It can go on for years.
Well, it just tightens everything. It constricts
you. It makes you not have a nice life.
Yeah. So,
and the thing is you have to remember it's all inside of you, so even if the person is on the other side of the world, or they're in New York, and you're here in California, it doesn't matter, because they're inside of you, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's work that needs to be done so that I can enjoy my life. Mm-hmm. There's one psychologist, I think his name's Fred Luskin. I've listened to some of his things. He has one phrase I like. He says, a person's taking up too much real estate in your mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just taking way too much real estate. Mm-hmm. You know? It's not worth it.
Mm-hmm. What's the name that you said?
His name is Luskin.
No, the name of the...
Oh, Pratipaksha Bhavana. Pratipaksha means bringing in the opposite.
Paksha.
Paksha means side.
Yeah.
So pratipaksha means bringing in the other side.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And bhavana means the emotion, you know.
Rather, that's not a one-time deal.
Oh,
that's
going to
be
nice.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. So nice to meet
you.
Yeah. Babysitter.
Bye.
Who's the babysitter?
Her, their children.
Oh.
Yeah. The babysitter's done at 9, so they've got her.
Well, that's like Cinderella, you know,
yeah.
Pumpkin time.
We're done anyway. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Martina. I'm ready.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Positive.
I'm not sure how to really formulate that question, but maybe you get what I mean. When you have knowledge of who you are,
mm-hmm.
you know you're the self.
Yeah.
And you sometimes have as an experience, but also you know it, but it still feels like it actually has become another object.
That what has become another
object? Like the self is actually
another object.
Another object. I just wonder, is that a kind of almost like a development where it is first an object and you understand it to a certain level, and then it goes like poof, and at one point you understand it in more depth?
Oh, good.
Good save.
Well, good save, yeah.
Does that question make sense? It feels like that. It's almost more like an object to a certain degree. I mean, there is the knowledge, but it's looked at times so where it feels like it just becomes maybe another object to inquire into, because the knowledge is not, the knowledge is not so complete that it's like, that there's an umph or an aha, that it's really,
mm-hmm.
oh, I am that.
I think I might know what you mean. It's like the teaching is taking place and they're talking about this self. And so we're all as though looking at the self as an object rather than having the words land on your own self-experience. Is that right?
It's not that far away, but it still doesn't feel like... It's not like out there somewhere. I think it's... It is landing to a certain degree, but it feels like it could land more. I think that's... That's what I'm
How could it land more? No, I'm serious.
I mean, if I would completely know that I'm whole and complete,
yeah.
and I would have no doubt,
yeah.
I mean, then I would be free. Then it's completely understood and landed. Hmm?
You know, the thing is that I think it becomes, that there is some sort of an aha moment,
mm-hmm.
in terms of what we mean by ananda and the ever-present nature of that ananda as yourself. And until we get that kind of recognition, nothing else really makes any difference, because I have to recognize the fullness of my being that's always there. And the thing is that fullness, bliss, ananda, all of these words are so associated with mental states.
Yeah.
You know, that the mental states, our knowledge of the mental states that we have, pleasurable, happy, blissful mental states, almost blocks, acts as a barricade toward recognizing the fullness of me that is always there no matter what the mental state.
And with an aha moment, I would think like all doubt is gone. Is that right?
Well, now there's all doubt. Well, no, this is a really important question. In terms of the recognition of yourself, when you really get it, that is yourself, and it will always be yourself, and it will never not be yourself. That's over.
Mm-hmm.
But Ishwara, relationship of the jiva to Ishwara, all of the things that need to be understood about mitya, all the variables, how the mind works, all of these things, and the mitya's relationship to the self, Ishwara's relationship to the self, where there's so much teaching you know, that takes more time in some hard to express way. Another thing is that you think you know yourself for a long time and you don't. And the reason is because of this confusion around ananda, where you're waiting for the mind to become blissful. Or you'll say things like, Swamiji always makes fun of this. Not to make fun, he's not trying to make fun of us, but he wants us to get it. It's like, as a student will always say, Swamiji, I really get it, I really understand, you know, Swamiji, but when will I be happy? You know, when will that ananda be there, like that? When will that, I understand and everything, but when will the ananda be there? And that means you really don't understand, because the ananda is never not there, you know. It's never not there. And so if you think that, if you haven't recognized what is meant by the ananda, then you're waiting for it to come. See what I mean? So you have to recognize, and that's, for me, it was a big aha moment. It's like, that's what is meant. That is the beloved, and it is the beloved. There is nothing more dear. That is the ananda. That is what they mean by the wholeness. And yes, it is never not there. And there's nothing more important. There's nothing more dear. But it's not what you expected by the word bliss or kind of the enlightenment. You expect some big thing rather than the very normal, simple thing that it is.
Or a simple, steady state of being happy.
Of being whole. But even when I say the normal, simple thing that it is, there really is nothing better than that. But it's normal. It's not some, you know, exalted state, even though there's nothing more exalted. That which is exalted is the baseline of what is here all the time. And it's totally taken for granted. I would say, like, that which is the most beloved, which is the most exalted, which is more important than anything else, nothing compares to it in any way, is totally taken for granted. And then we're looking for these, like, bliss states and all of these different experiences and those type of things, which are nothing, nothing compared to what is already here. And so, you know, that's a real unwinding that has to take place. And then you realize that, you know, what is the most extraordinary is what has always been here.
I think sometimes if I'm really questioned, like, so you can sometimes know that everything is happening in me, and then it's not anymore. Right? So it's like, it's for me, it's not so much looking for bliss states,
yeah,
but just like, maybe that attachment to the continuous knowing or something. I mean, it's an experience to a certain degree, no? But there is
well, the experience of yourself is not as an object, but as your being is always present. Mm-hmm. One thing you can do is, when you notice it, then just go on, keep noticing it, like throughout the day. Mm-hmm. Keep checking back in. In your morning meditation and evening meditation, just check back in. You know, I used to do that because I used to be afraid, am I going to lose it? You walk around like this. Am I going to lose it? You know, but once you get it, then you just keep checking back in. You're still there. And then after some time, you don't have to do that anymore because you're always still there. Mm-hmm. And then you're not always still there. It doesn't require any checking back in. It's just you. You know, but the mind has to do that kind of stuff at first. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Well, it's almost like retraining the mind.
Well, it has been, you know, since beginningless time, so used to being one with your being. So whatever is going on in your mind is what is going on with you. There's no viveka at all. It's like, you know, the Hamsaburg with the milk and water. It's that much, the mitya, the maya, and the atma are in one place. The only thing is that the Atma, the self, is the conscious being, and the Maya is not. And the Maya is not in the sense that it keeps coming and going and changing, you know? If it's coming and going, and the conscious being is staying, that Maya is not dependent, and the consciousness is not dependent on the Maya at all. But when Maya is there, it's consciousness. But it comes and goes, so you can differentiate it.
And relax.
Relaxation is good. Because that's all the mind, that's all the Shantavritti is, really.
But can you have knowledge and still be ahankara?
Can be doing all kinds of stuff.
Right, so there can still be pride and anger and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. But that's why they say, only you and your guru know that you know. Because the only way another person is going to know, and they don't really know either, but you seem to have all the gunas and the qualities of what they think a Mahatma is. You know? And so if your mind is still immature in this way, or it's acting out, or you still have emotions that you're dealing with, they can look at you and say, oh, look, this guy is still getting angry and doing this and that. What does he know? How?
Because it does seem a little contradictory when you, for example, you get angry or proud, then you're still, at that moment, it seems you are identifying with the mind, even though you know.
I would say like this, the mind can be carrying on, but what we call, it's actually called pratibandhika jnanam, knowledge with pratibandhika's obstructions. There comes a time when no matter what your mind does, even if it reacts or behaves in a way that, you know, is not really indicative of your having knowledge, it doesn't cover your knowledge and it doesn't cover you. It's not, it doesn't displace you. And so, it doesn't displace your knowledge. But then you have to deal with the mind that's like that. You know, if that's burdensome to you and to others, then you work on it. You know? If it doesn't make any difference to you or to anybody else, then that's just your personality and it's fine. You're a gruff kind of guy, you know? But if it hurts you and it hurts other people, then you need to work on it because their hurt will be a hurt for you, you know?
But I still wonder though, this thing of, still when you have, like, for example, pride or something, it seems like then, you know, there is an identification. No, even if you know who you are, but then in the moment it seems like you've lapsed into some identification. You know, this person insulted me or whatever, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but see how you're saying blah, blah, blah. It's like, how to explain it? It's like the mithya mind.
Yeah.
It still has areas where it needs to mature. And your buddhi will come to its rescue. The buddhi comes to the rescue of the mind when its feelings are hurt, or the mind when, you know, it feels its pride is wounded. All of these type of kind of human emotions, you know. So your buddhi that has knowledge and is kind of an inner friend comes to the rescue of that part of you that's having these problems.
So that's why these practices like relaxing with these feelings, particularly if you already know who you are, that can be very powerful.
Very, very powerful. And also your buddhi, you should, if your buddhi has gotten, you know, as you gain that nishta, then you can make a division between the buddhi and the manas. And so in the manas there's all, in the chitta, the memory, there's all this habitual behavior, habitual ways of being triggered, unconscious stuff coming up. And so the buddhi is the one that has the clarity. And so that one, the buddhi will come to the rescue. That's why this inner friend is so important. Will come and say, you know, say your pride has been wounded. You'll come and say, you know, tell me what your pride has been wounded. You know, tell me what's going on, what you're feeling. And let that part talk all about it, you know, and then And then after it's said everything and it feels, and you can say, you know, it's okay, it'll be all right. This doesn't really matter anyway.
Right.
Then it'll relax, and then you can bring your knowledge in, and then everything's fine. Okay. But when something flares up like that, you need to help.
Yeah.
And if your buddhi doesn't have the problem, the reaction has the problem, and you can help. And that's when you have nishta. If you can come to the help, to the aid, then there's no problem, except that your mind is still in that maturing process, which will go on for a long time, so you have to be patient.
Should you be disappointed if it takes longer than it's supposed to?
There is no supposed to, and you shouldn't be disappointed, because that's like being disappointed in your child that's trying to grow and learn, you know. Your child, you're still a child in reference to your knowledge. You have to let all of that maturing take place, and in order for it to take place, you need to provide it with a nice home, which gives, you know, support and wants to help and knows the tricks of the trade to help in these situations. And
but if you express your anger, though, or you lash out because we're in pain, you lose your booties.
When you get lost and
you lose your booty.
But it'll come back, you do. You know, it's like being hit by a tidal wave. But the emotion doesn't last. The buddhi remains. The emotion doesn't last. It can totally overwhelm you, but it will recede, and your buddhi will be left intact. And so then you have to apologize or something to the people that
you
left
mature,
as a puddle on the floor.
But rather, the maturity comes in, like, to know what that where that goes and what that does, rubbing your back up against the bark of a tree, or sticking your hand in the cookie jar.
Yeah.
So you know, after a while,
you
catch that quicker.
Absolutely, you catch it quicker. You keep working on it, and you catch it more and more quickly until finally, you know, it doesn't come anymore. But until that time, you keep working with it and training it.
It's like you said, you know, can you give yourself 10 minutes before you act out?
Yeah. That's a good one, especially if you do it and try to relax.
Well, it helps when you're at the ashram and you don't talk for a week.
Yeah. But really, you know, I mean, that's a psychological tool. You say you're having a rage has come and you're ready to hit somebody or whatever. You wait 10 minutes. Take a walk, 10 minutes. That's not very long. But what that does is it gives you strength, that dhamma, you know, shama dhamma. Mm-hmm. And it gives the mind a lot of strength, the buddhi a lot of strength. And who knows what happens after 10 minutes, but at least you've given 10 minutes. Yeah.
It's like quitting smoking. It's the same.
Yeah. You know, also, say you have that 10 minutes. You can, if you take a walk and learn how to relax, learn how to relax your mind. That's such a beautiful skill. You know, that skill you can develop that skill of relaxing your mind. It can be almost instantaneous. You just say relax and that's it. But you have to practice it. And take a walk and just relax. Relax your body, relax your mind. And the tremendous rage that had come up can't hang on when you're relaxing. I admit certain other things come in to stop you from wanting to do that. But you do get to a place where there is no other thing. You just do that. Because nothing, it's not worth it. You have no value for the stress or for the bad feelings. There's no reason to go through life having those feelings. You don't want them.
And there's no return by having.
No, the return is painful. That's why more and more you give up it's really giving up the ahankara, the justification, you know, you feel justified. This person has hurt me and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. After a while, you don't care about any of that. You don't want it. Mm-hmm. It's not meaningful. Mm-hmm. You can deal objectively with the problem. Because it's not that the problem, but so you can deal objectively with the problem, you don't have to have the suffering.
Yeah, the monkey that sticks it.
Yeah, the monkey, I love that.
Jar and gets beaten up as a pulp by the owner of the house. Maybe you always say that?
I tell all my students at CIS that story too.
Well, they love that story.
They love that story, yeah.
What's that story?
You know where you put the monkey that puts its hand in the jar? You know that story?
And then it can't get out?
Yeah,
right.
To get a handful of nuts. But the jar, the hole into the jar is real small, so when it gets it, it can't pull the hand out if it keeps the nuts.
And he won't let go.
He won't let go until he's beaten to a pulp. Yeah. And finally, after he's almost dead, he lets go and then scampers off. That's how we are.
A bunch of monkeys.
That's like what suffering is for, or something.
Let go.
Sorry.
Well, good. Bhagavad Gita.
Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.